listener production. This is Global Truths with Dr. Keith Suter. Join us each week as we break down one issue in global politics so that you can understand what's going on in the world right now and also what's likely to happen in the future. Our host, Dr. Keith Suter, is one of Australia's leading commentators on global affairs and geopolitics. My name is Sasha Barber-Gatt. I'm a journalist. This year, the United Nations released a new set of policy proposals titled A New Agenda for Peace. So what is it and what does it mean? Who better to explain it to us than Keith? Thank you for joining us. Tell us more about this new agenda for peace, but also what happened to the old one?
So the old one was released by the then UN Secretary General Boutros Ghali back in 1992.
Wow.
It's quite frightening. For me, it seemed like yesterday.
It's 1 year older than me.
So just to give us a bit of context here, what we're now calling the old agenda for peace was a document that reflected what we thought was this new optimistic era in world affairs. So the UN created back in 1945. Then we get the Cold War, which froze everything. So a lot of the innovations that are in the UN Charter were never implemented because the Americans and the Russians, or Soviet Union, kept falling out. So between 1989, 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed, the end of the war, end of the Cold War, and it was a whole new era emerging. You know, what George Bush Sr. referred to as a new world order emerging. And the then UN Secretary General, Boutros Ghali, capitalized on this new spirit of optimism and new hope for world peace by this agenda called an Agenda for Peace. What he was hoping to achieve would be to have the UN released from all the old Cold War tensions, which froze the UN, and instead the UN will be able to flourish.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, for example, hardly any peacekeeping operations between 1945 and 1990. And then suddenly, since 1990, we've had a whole series of peacekeeping operations. We've also had the creation of the doctrine of the responsibility to protect, the argument being that it's a national government's responsibility to protect its own citizens. But then if it is failing to protect its own citizens, the international community has an international responsibility to protect and so gets involved in a country's internal affairs. So these were all incredibly optimistic, you know, developments, a whole new world. Well, as George Bush Sr. said, it's a whole new world, which was emerging. And the Soviet Union collapsed. Russia was not in such a position to keep blocking initiatives. And America had a good, clear run, originally under George Bush Sr. and then under Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was president at a time when no American soldier was killed in action. It's the only time you could say that, going all the way back to 1940.
Wow.
You know, you had a period when American soldiers were not being killed on operational work. There was this mood of optimism, but it's really petered out. And so the current Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, is trying to create a UN which is more appropriate for the international political context that we have today.
Okay.
And in effect, in his new agenda for peace, he is far less ambitious, far less visionary in that sense compared with Boutros Ghali from 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he's simply saying, look, the UN will be around to help countries, but ultimately countries have got to sort out their own internal affairs. You can't just keep referring everything back to the UN because we're back, unfortunately, to deadlocks at the UN Security Council.
Yeah.
You know, one of the tragedies is that the Republic of Ireland put up a resolution at the UN Security Council talking about the need to treat climate change as a security issue. And the Russians vetoed it.
Mm.
The Russians said there is not a clear connection between climate change and insecurity. Now, a number of us would contradict the Russians.
Yeah.
But the Russians vetoed that. So it showed that the UN Security Council was hesitant about getting involved with climate change issues. So Antonio Guterres, the current UN Secretary General, I think he's just being realistic about what the UN can achieve. And the UN is not a large organization. There are more people employed in Disney World than employed in the UN Secretariat. So it's not a huge organization.
Mm.
It's not a world government. It has real limitations on how it can intervene in affairs. And I think Antonio Guterres is just simply trying to introduce an element of realism into all the proceedings.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think the notion of peace and world peace does feel so far away at the moment. It's interesting to see the UN has kind of gone for this measured approach,
yep.
I suppose. Let's talk through the five main points that it's put forward in this in this proposal. So the first one is prevention at the global level, addressing strategic risks and geopolitical divisions. What does that mean?
It means really this overall international agenda, just trying to get people to focus on these geostrategic risks.
Mm.
The way in which international politics tends to operate is just you lurch from one crisis to the next. You know, look at what's going on as we speak at the moment and what's happening in Central Africa, for example. A whole new series of issues have just suddenly emerged, and we don't have adequate ways of trying to address those issues. Now, what the UN Secretary General is saying is that countries have just got to lift their game. Now, we are very good in Australia in making preparations for some crises. We're very active in the South Pacific, for example. But we want other countries to adopt Australia's approach in terms of prevention of conflict. The problem is that governments tend to be very reactive. They're presented with a crisis and then they will get involved. So we had a period in Australia, it actually going back to where we were 30 years ago, when we created a centre for peacekeeping up at Newcastle in New South Wales. We were actually training Australian soldiers to be ready to carry out UN peacekeeping operations. I'm not sure what's happened to that centre. I'm not coming across any references to it. I think it was just allowed to lapse.
Right.
As we've deployed the Australians for other activities, such as Iraq and Afghanistan.
Wars. Yeah.
So we're back to these immediate crises.
Mm.
But we're actually doing good work. And the Canadians, I have to pay tribute, they were the trailblazers in this, in preparing troops for potential peacekeeping operations. So you've got everything in place. If you look at the UN's history in peacekeeping, it's not been particularly good. Now, people say, oh, the UN should have its own army, etc. Read the UN Charter. I spend so much of my time using that phrase, read the Charter. The UN was not set up in order to fail.
Mm.
And Winston Churchill and the other architects actually wanted the UN to have its own army. We have the mechanism on paper for there to be a UN army. It's all there.
Right.
Right? It's just a lack of political will.
Mm-hmm.
And the politicians are back to this sort of short-term ad hoc way of doing things rather than actually following what's in the UN Charter. If you were to get that being implemented, then we would end up with a different situation. So in the mid-1950s, we had a political crisis in the Middle East. The UN Secretary General at that time was Dag Hammarskjöld, and he invented peacekeeping. The word doesn't appear in the UN Charter. This is a way of sending forces in. They're unarmed and they are interposed between fighting sides, in this case between the Israelis and the Egyptians. And so he invented peacekeeping on the fly. And then 4 years later, we get the crisis in Congo. There was not even a map of the Congo in the UN building.
Wow.
They had to send somebody down to Wall Street to a shipping company to get a really detailed map. It just shows, you know, that we're coming off such a low base.
Yeah.
And we've got to do so much more. And that's what the UN Secretary General is encouraging, but now encouraging governments to be doing it rather than saying we're going to leave things to the UN. There was always a tradition in the 1950s that you left things to Dag. You left everything to Dag Hammarskjöld to sort out.
Uh-huh. That makes sense. So that makes the next point that they make, preventing conflict and violence and sustaining peace, pretty obvious. That's what we've just talked about.
And that would include, obviously, climate change.
Yeah.
You know, the drivers of violence. It would mean, obviously, increasing foreign aid, for example, because poverty is also itself a cause of violence.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then also strengthening peace operations and addressing peace enforcement. So they want more peacekeeping.
That's right. So peace enforcement is what the UN was actually designed to do, almost like having its own army and saying to people, you will not fight wars. We will find another way of trying to settle things. The problem, again, is that it just shows how complicated the world is becoming. The problem with a lot of this violence is actually it's local violence. The UN was designed to deal with international conflicts, one country invading another, because that's what we'd lived through, World War II.
Yeah.
And then we'd had, prior to that, we had the German aggression in the Rhineland, Poland, et cetera, the Italians in Ethiopia. But increasingly, we've got more and more domestic violence in the sense that it's not one country invading another, it's one country falling apart because of issues of poverty, tribal violence, et cetera. And that's much more difficult to sort out. And that's what we found in Australia, for example, in Afghanistan. We were in a country that really you need a whole army of anthropologists to understand what is going on, rather than just straightforward military operations.
Mm. A heavy-handed approach to something that was probably a lot more nuanced.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is Global Truths with Dr. Keith Suter. Thanks for your company as we discuss a new UN plan for peace. Now, there's two more points that they make. Novel approaches to peace and potential domains of conflict. Novel as in not regular?
New. Yeah. Okay. So what they're saying, because, you know, we've now got a whole range of peace research centres around the world. In fact, I was president of one here in Sydney for many years. So there are many new ideas being generated about peace. Of course, a major one is that we have more women deployed on peacekeeping operations.
Makes sense.
That's very sensible. Mm-hmm. Well, it hasn't been done too much in the past. They're now working on it. But very late in life, we've discovered that women make good peacekeepers.
Fancy that.
Another approach is the deployment of police officers. Australia was a pioneer here. We've got a UN police force working with the peacekeeping troops on Cyprus.
Right.
Or have done anyway.
Yep.
I'm not sure how many we've got deployed at the moment. Because a lot of the work that is being done is actually more suitable for police officers to go in and sort out disputes rather than heavy-handed soldiers.
Mm.
So that was also an innovation that was started in Cyprus. So perhaps recruiting more police officers for operations. So there are plenty of ideas in circulation. It's just to get governments to be more open.
Mm. Well, speaking of that, the final of the 5 points is strengthening international governance. So is that kind of trying to put more of the onus onto individual countries to look after themselves?
Exactly. And for them to fund the UN operations properly at any one time. You've always got countries that are in debt to the UN. They're not paying their annual subscriptions. The sums of money are not large. And governments can afford to have all these fat cat diplomats in New York, but they're not actually paying their membership subscriptions to the UN.
Mm.
And the United States for many years was in debt, and the Soviet Union also got itself into debt. The British, by contrast, always pay their subscription a year in advance.
Mm.
It was a tradition that began in the days of the League of Nations they've just maintained. Even Margaret Thatcher was still paying. Even though she was critical of the UN, the British still continued to pay a year in advance.
Yeah, this feels like a good time to look at the UN's role in general. While these notions for peace are obviously admirable and, you know, part of the UN's modus operandi, that's what they're supposed to do, member states can choose to take these proposals or leave them, can't they? It's all just a suggestion.
That's right. So there are rules that are mandatory, but countries can ignore them, like the paying of subscriptions.
Mm.
You actually lose your right to vote, except that that rule has been rarely exercised on governments. So, yes, governments are just free. This is what's called national sovereignty.
Mm.
Governments are just free to do it. And so, if you like, the current UN Secretary General is recognising that limitation. And so he's saying, look, it's really up to governments to do more. And Australia, as I said, has tried to do that in some cases occasionally. So for once, we're almost on the side of the angels. But there's obviously a lot more that we could be doing.
Mm. Let's talk generally, and this is probably a bit of a, I don't know, existential question. But I wanted to ask you how you think we are tracking globally for peace. It feels like a very tumultuous time at the moment.
Yeah.
And I feel like every generation thinks this is the worst it's ever been. Do you think that holds up, or do you think we've seen worse in our history?
Oh, we have.
Yeah.
Barbara Tuchman, during the time of the nuclear crisis in the 1970s and 1980s, was horrified by the depression in America caused by people just saying it's the end of the world, we're going to have a nuclear war, because we were preparing for a nuclear war in the mid-1980s. So government departments in the US were being tasked with working out how you would still operate in the event of World War III. And the US Postal Service said, we can guarantee that we can get the mail to go through, mm-hmm. even in the event of nuclear war. So Barbara Tuchman wrote a book called A Distant Mirror, talking about what life was like in Europe in the 14th century. So if you're a medieval historian, you stop in the 13th century. If you're a modern historian, you begin in the 15th century. Nobody wants to touch the 14th century because it was just an awful time to have lived. And so, you know, she was saying, in effect, look, if you think today it's pretty gloomy, just be glad that you weren't in the 14th century with your bubonic plague and labour unrest and all the rest of it. You were in a much better position. So I think it is important to get a sense of perspective.
Mm.
And somehow humans managed to survive. Now, that can very easily lead to a sense of complacency. Somehow we will always continue to flourish.
Yeah.
That can be risky, but it means that it gives us more grounds for hope than you would normally expect, because clearly we have managed to somehow continue to limp forward.
Mm-hmm.
When you actually look at the world and you look at what we could do, then it is depressing. You know, the Americans spent 20 years fighting a war in Afghanistan, spending $300 million per day for 20 years. They could find the money for war, but not for peace.
Yeah.
Imagine how they could have transformed their own country if they were spending such huge sums of money on something as basic as, say, healthcare and repairing bridges and roads. And so they were feeding the military machine, but not the civilian sector. So when you look at our potential, we could actually do a lot better. So my second doctorate, which looked at military expenditure, looked at what we could do if we were to divert military expenditure into civilian uses. So, for example, I found out that I could provide water throughout Africa in about 30 days of military expenditure.
Wow.
So you could actually reinvent a whole new continent in Africa with the military expenditure that is going underway. So that's the tragedy, that when you look at what could be achieved, we are falling far short.
Yeah.
But we're probably not quite as bad as some of the doomsters would have us suggest. Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, has pointed out how close we are to midnight. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, created after World War II from scientists who are involved in making nuclear weapons, who then regretted their work. So they have a clock and they try to calculate how close we are to World War III.
Mm.
And at the moment, we are probably the closest to that point we've been for many decades.
90 seconds.
90 seconds, yeah.
That's the official number, yeah. Look, I guess that's the important thing, is we can put everything into perspective. But, you know, he's hoping maybe some new plans for peace could spur some good humanity among the countries.
And this will be particularly important for September of next year when we have this UN session looking at the summit on the future. I only hope that Australia's going to be represented by the Prime Minister, whoever that person may be at that time, but to be represented by the Prime Minister and show that we are concerned about what's coming out of the UN and be willing to continue to work with it, including increasing foreign aid.
That's a big part of the puzzle. Keith, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Global Truths is presented by Dr. Keith Suter and me, Sasha Barber-Gatt. Audio production by Niall Fernandez. Theme and original music by Matt Nikolic.